Following episode of K-Voice was recorded at 10:33 p.m., April 10th, 2017. So things may have changed by the time you listen to the episode. Enjoy the show!
No more war!
Hello. Thank you for listening to K-Voice of the Resistance. That's the letter K. Voice of the Resistance. I'm Kelly the Voice. Off the top, I need to retract something from my last show. I gave a shout out to Fareed Zakaria for saying this.
I think the president is somewhat indifferent to things that are true or false. He has spent his whole life bullshitting. He has succeeded by bullshitting. He has gotten the presidency by bullshitting. It's very hard to tell somebody at that point that bullshit doesn't work because look at the results, right?
I used him as an example to show that some mainstream media can tell it like it is. That was, however, just before he said this.
I think Donald Trump became president of the United States. I think this was actually a big moment.
This media fawning over bombing is disgusting and shameful. I don't care if you approve the military action or not, but bombing other countries should not be the standard for what makes a president. Is the bar so low for our white supremacist president that a few bombs turn him around from the most inept president we have ever had to a great one? How many times has the media fallen all over themselves to normalize this man in some battered spouse syndrome need to make the bad man seem okay? Just listen.
There's a new sheriff in town, and you know what? The new sheriff wants to look like RoboCop compared to the last one.
I think that the moment when someone becomes president of the United States is the moment when they first really use American military might.
That is a decisive use of American power.
We not only took out a Syrian Air Force base, we took out a terrorist airstrip.
That sends quite a message. That's what's going to happen if you continue to use these chemical weapons.
This is a president who's coming off of a rocky couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Arguably, he's turned the page on that to some extent with these foreign leader meetings that he's had this week and now with the focus on Syria.
How cool is that to actually make the Chinese Politburo sit through a night of American targeted bombing?
We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons." And they are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over to this airfield.
That is a segment of a 4-minute compilation Media Matters put together, and I won't make you suffer through all of it. If you're not familiar with Media Matters, check them out. Donate. Here is my fear. We have a president who has a clinical pathological need to be loved, and one who takes his cues from the media, of which he watches constantly. What cue do you think he is taking now? Bombing other countries gives him exactly what he wants, what he needs. This is irresponsible and shameful. Write, call, letter to the editor, do what you have to do to contact media outlets and let them know that celebrating bombs and normalizing the president is not okay. And it is irresponsible reporting. Not all the media, mind you. It is important not to write them all off entirely. Not all fell over themselves in praise because
president, bang, bang, whoosh, whoosh, he got to turn the key and watch the pretty rockets go.
That was Rick Wilson you just heard. Charlie Pierce, Richard Engel, Rachel Maddow, Lawrence O'Donnell, Christopher Hayes, many, many pundits and multiple print news organizations. Those are just a few who came out against the media's praise and also were critical of the strike. But as Dan Rather said the night after the attack, quote, "The number of members of the press who have lauded the actions last night as presidential is concerning. War must never be considered a public relations operation. It is not a way for an administration to gain a narrative. It is a step into a dangerous unknown, and its full impact is impossible to predict, especially in the immediate wake of the first strike." Unquote. This whole thing makes me sick. I'm not going to pass judgment on whether it was correct action or not, but I will say that unilateral military action by the president needs to stop. The framers of of this country, put it in the Constitution so that the president must get approval of Congress before committing acts of war. They did this to prevent the president from having an emotional moment and reacting without thought or discussion. Reportedly, Donald had a emotional reaction to the images of the kids who could not breathe. Sorry, but the cynical side of me thinks that the media is gullible for believing he had any such reaction. Who's telling us this? The administration and himself. And oh no, they have never been known to lie. Yeah, right. I don't believe it. When he starts letting refugees in this country, then maybe I'll believe that he has some emotions about dead Syrian children. And consider this. Imagine Hillary Clinton, a woman. She had became president, and she had an emotional reaction to images she saw coming out of the TV, and then she started bombing them. The backlash would be immediate and brutal. Donald emotional? Please. Anyway, were his actions illegal? Yes, and kind of, no. Unless we are going to go back and charge Reagan for his 1986 bombing of Libya, or Clinton for his 1999 bombing of Serbia, or Obama for his 2011 bombing of Libya. When Obama was considering his own strikes to deter Assad's chemical weapons use in 2013, which was, by the way, a far worse chemical attack than this most recent one, Obama did decide to ask Congress for authorization. And they refused to even take a vote. As Slate reports, it's also worth considering that the US has already been bombing Syria territory since 2014. These strikes are somewhat justified, if only under the 2001 law passed by Congress following 9/11. The law called the Authorization for Use of Military Force gives him permission to direct military force to prevent future terror attacks against the US. President Bush, Obama, and Trump have used an expansive view of this authority to fight both Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere. Bottom line, this action being illegal is not an argument that will fly. What we need to do is push our representatives to push for a return to the Constitution and officially push for the authorization of war to be decided in Congress. The founders intended for the powers of war to be left to Congress. They are hard to convince to go to war. And as Rachel Maddow says, when it comes to going to war, quote, the reasons are about to get very, very perverse, unquote. America has a long and bloody legacy.
This is a different kind of war. There are no marching armies or solemn declarations. This is really war.
I implemented a plan to train and equip the South Vietnamese to withdraw American forces and to end American involvement in the war just as soon as the South Vietnamese had developed the capacity to defend their country against communist aggression.
And this is the meaning in the phrase of Barry Goldwater, peace through strength. Winston Churchill said the destiny of man is not measured by material computations. When great forces are on the move in the world, we learn we're spirits, not animals. And he said there's something going on in time and space and beyond time and space, which, whether we like it or not, spells duty.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
My fellow Americans, today, our armed forces joined our NATO allies in airstrikes against Serbian forces responsible for the brutality in Kosovo.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
Last month, I ordered our military to take targeted action against ISIL to stop its advances. Since then, we've conducted more than 150 successful airstrikes in Iraq.
Tonight, I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
Johnson, Nixon, Reagan, Bush Sr., Bush Jr., Clinton, Obama, and Trump. I have to tell you, working on this episode, I have found it difficult to stay positive, and the inclination to detach and retreat has been strong in the face of seemingly impossible odds. But now more than ever, we need to push forward and continue to fight for what is right and what is just.
Zora Neale Hurston said, if you are silent, about your pain, they will kill you and say you enjoyed it. In other words, silence is not an option. Dr. Clint King declared we needed a moral revolution in 67, and if we needed a moral revolution in 67, God knows we need a moral revival today. We need a political Pentecost where we regain our speech and we learn once again how to talk in the tongues of justice and love and mercy, that we can challenge the narrative of the forces of oppression. We have to begin to reframe the conversation, not to talk about left policies and right policies, but let's talk about violence versus nonviolence. You know how Coretta Scott King said it. She said, listen, poverty can produce violence. She said, starving a child is violence. Suppressing a culture is violence. Neglecting school children is violence. Discrimination against a working person is violence. Ghetto housing is violence. Ignoring people's medical needs is violence. Contempt for equality is violence. And even a lack of willpower to do anything or say anything to help humanity is a sick and sinister form of violence. So the question for us today is, are we going to be on the side of violence or nonviolence? I choose nonviolence.
That was Dr. William J. Barber II with his sermon, When the Silence is Not an Option series, Beyond the Dream, Living King's Legacy at Riverside Church, New York. This speech is beautiful and inspiring, and I'm not a religious person. I posted it on my Facebook page, K Voice of Resistance, if you would like to view it in its entirety. Just days after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis on April 4th, 1968, Coretta King led a march on behalf of sanitation workers, substituting for her husband, and later in the month, keeping his speaking engagement at an anti-Vietnam War rally in New York. In May, she also helped launch the March on Washington for the Poor People's Campaign, thereafter participating in numerous poverty efforts. She devoted her life to actively propagating her husband's philosophy of nonviolence. We must be willing to stand in the footsteps of giants and fight for what is right. Let our fight for justice build us up to not drain our reserves.
Thousands of demonstrators opposed to the Vietnam War assembled in the nation's capital for a mass protest. For the most part orderly, minor scuffles did occur between the demonstrators and hecklers. A three-hour parade takes the demonstrators across the Potomac on their way to the Pentagon. The crowd, estimated at about 50,000 persons, was a loose confederation of some 150 groups and included adults, students, even children. It is at the Pentagon where the first test of strength comes. Military police contain the crowd, but clashes soon break out. Federal marshals arrest several who attempt to break through the protective line.
And so will we march, and we will protest, and we will fight. In 1965, anti-war protest gained prominence after U.S. upped its bombing campaign in Vietnam. In 1968, after the successful Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese troops proved that the war's end was nowhere in sight, the protest really surged. By November 1967, American troop strength in Vietnam was approaching 500,000. The U.S. casualties had reached 15,058 killed and 109,527 wounded. The Vietnam War was costing the U.S. some $25 billion per year, and disillusionment was beginning to reach greater sections of the taxpaying public. More casualties were reported in Vietnam every day, even as U.S. commanders demanded more troops. Nixon claimed in a famous speech that anti-war protesters constituted a small, albeit vocal, minority that should not be allowed to drown out the silent majority of Americans. Sound familiar? He was, in fact, ignoring the polls that had 50% of America against the war, and only 35% in favor. The rest, bewilderingly, have no opinion, but there's always, you know, those guys. Nixon's war policies divided the nation still further, however. In 1969, the government instituted the first U.S. draft lottery since World War II. Under the draft system, as many as 40,000 young men were called into service each month, adding fuel to the fire of the anti-war movement. In 1969, Barbara Jean Grewell watched her friend, her protector, her brother leave for a second time to a war she was too young to understand on the other side of the world. Her brother did not want to be in Vietnam. They had promised not to send him back for a second tour. He was not supposed to be there. On November 24, 1969, Larry Irwin Grewell filled in for a buddy who was sick. He hopped on a plane to deliver supplies. A welcome trip compared to the ones where he was picking up bodies. That would be his final trip. On November 24th, 1969, Larry Irwin Grewell and the 7 other crew members on his plane were shot down. Barbara would never see her brother again. Barbara is my mom. She is not much of a crier. She does not like to show weakness. After the Women's March in D.C., we went to Arlington National Cemetery to visit his grave. It is forever striking walking among the endless rows of white headstones. All that is left of countless lives. The true cost of war, painfully present. He wasn't supposed to go back, my mom said. He wasn't supposed to go back, she repeated, bent over her brother's grave. The mass grave. She continued, I'm sorry. It never gets better. It never stops hurting. She went on to recount the moment they came to her house to tell her family he'd been declared missing in action. She described the feeling as they were walking up to the door, how they knew before the soldier even knocked. Her life, her family's life, shattered, and the course of their lives changed forever. Our deceased soldiers are not the only casualties of war. These men and women in power, who so casually condemn the citizens to death and loss. When a wealthy man who knows nothing of service holds in his hands the powers of war, we must stand up and fight back. When more wars are fought for oil and greed rather than justice and humanity, we must stand up and fight back. When only the poorest citizens fight on the front lines, we must stand up and fight back. And when a country as rich as ours refuses to fund the healthcare for our veterans, we must stand up and fight back. If our soldiers are to fall, let it be for a just cause. So long as one soldier dies in vain, we have no choice but to stand up and fight back. In mid-1971, with the publication of the first Pentagon Papers, which revealed previously confidential details about the war's conduct, it caused more Americans to question the accountability of the U.S. government and military establishments. In response to a strong anti-war mandate, Nixon announced the effective end to U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia in January 1973. In the end, 58,209 Americans died during the war. Let us hold the line of our own anti-war mandate before it is too late.
Silence. Silence is not an option you can choose anymore. We must, with moral language, say we are against policies, not because they are conservative policies or liberal policies, but we are against these policies because they are morally indefensible and they are constitutionally inconsistent and economically insane.
Good news coming out of Texas. The New York Times reports, a federal judge ruled on Monday that the voter identification law that the Texas legislature passed in 2011 was enacted with the intent to discriminate against Black and Hispanic voters, striking down the law and raising the possibility that the state's election procedures could be put back under federal oversight. And the Huffington Post reports, in a major victory for the movement to improve access to higher education, New York is set to become the first state to offer free tuition at four-year colleges. And San Francisco is to become the first city to offer free tuition to city residents starting next fall. State by state, we shall push the progressive agenda. Remember, it only took a couple states to make abortion legal before Roe versus Wade was the law of the land. We just gotta show them how it's done. And believe it or not, there's something in Congress that is getting bipartisan support. And you're not going to guess what for. Gary Cohen, senior White House economic advisor and National Economic Council director, who is a confusing guy, to be sure. He worked at Goldman Sachs for 27 years, but is also a registered Democrat who, according to The Heavy, has donated at least $275,000 to Democrats over the years, which is awesome, to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton during the 2008 Democratic primaries. However, he has also donated nearly the same amount of money, $250,000, to Republican candidates. Anyway, he met privately Wednesday with the Senate Banking Committee. In a meeting, Bloomberg reported that Cohen expressed his support for a policy that would separate consumer banking from investment banking. This separation was a key part of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was functionally repealed in 1999. The repealing of Glass-Steagall, they say, was partly responsible for the 2008 financial crisis. The revival of Glass-Steagall makes allies of Republicans and more progressive members of the Democratic Party. In 2015, Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act of 2015, which proposed to reinstate the firewall between investment banking and lending banking. By separating the two activities according to Countable, the government protection through the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, risky financial ventures would be removed. This would address the issue of too big to fail. Institutions on both sides of the equation could go under without causing such catastrophic economic fallouts that federal bailouts are required. So this is something not horrible going on in Washington. We will see how far it gets. And conservatives don't quite get a full gold star, as it comes at the sacrifice of Dodd-Frank, including the part of Dodd-Frank, which according to Think Progress specifically calls for either abolishing or restricting the Consumer Financial Protections Bureau, the agency tasked with regulating predatory products used by everyday consumers, and changing the way too-big-to-fail banks are dealt with in crisis. Let's be clear. Regulations are protections. Repeat after me. Regulations are protections. Anyhow, we will have to keep track of all these banking shenanigans, both good and bad, as they progress. Tuesday, Kansas. It is your day. With the Republican representative, Mike Pompeo, gone to the CIA, Democrat James Thompson is hoping for the upset of all upsets in Tuesday's special election in Wichita. It would take a miracle, but it is pretty incredible that Republicans even dragged out Mike Pence to record a new robocall to GOP voters to rally their depressed base in Kansas. And this is not the only race. John Ossoff is scaring the crap out of Republicans in Georgia. And then again, we also have Montana. Montana at large, U.S. House District, where Bob Quist, a banjo-playing, bluegrass-singing Democrat, is running. So back to Kansas. The National Republican Congressional Committee has jumped into the race with a last-minute, way-over-the-top attack ad against Democrat James Thompson, a veteran and a lawyer. One thing is clear. Republicans are sweating over the congressional race in Kansas. Don't get me wrong, this is a heavy lift, very heavy. The seat has been in Republican hands for more than two decades. It is deep red, and I mean deep red. And the left hasn't even bothered to challenge in years. But maybe that's part of the problem. They haven't been faced with an alternative. So yeah, heavy lift, blah, blah, blah. We can dream, can't we? Democrats are on their way to changing the face of the electorate, and even if we don't get a win, a good showing will put fear into conservatives who hold office, and hopefully they will pull back on some of their heinous legislation out of fear of getting primaried come midterms. The war on women goes global. Last week, Donald's administration defunded the United Nations Population Fund, the largest international maternal health organization on the planet, which provides family planning and reproductive health services. Last year, the United States contribution of $69 million, or the price of roughly a 35 taxpayer-funded weekends at Mar-a-Lago, helped prevent roughly 10,000 1,000 maternal deaths and 100,000 unsafe abortions. Today's daily action is to ask your member of Congress to state public support for the United Nations Population Fund. Women's lives depend on it. Dial 844-241-1141. Also, feel free to weigh in on the White House comment line at 202-456-1111. That's 202-456-1111. Okay. Report a hate crime. Please report incidents of hateful intimidation and harassment. If you do see a hate crime or a hateful incident, report it to your local law enforcement first. But next, submit the incident to the Southern Poverty Law Center. I've posted the link to where you can report the incident on my Facebook page at K Voice of Resistance. Using their form will aid in their work of monitoring around the country. You can also find their most recent report in hate incidents. The SPLC has collected 1,372 reported bias incidents between the day after the election and February 7th. These incidents were either reported directly to SPLC or via their report hate intake page, or collected from news reports. In an effort to better document and verify these incidents, they've partnered with ProPublica to share their database with an investigating team. The name of the project is Documenting Hate, and its mission is: hate crimes and bias incidents are a national problem, but there's no reliable data on the nature or prevalence of the violence. We're collecting and verifying reports to create a national database for use by journalists, researchers, and civil rights organizations.
Repeal and replace Obamacare.
Repealing and replacing Obamacare.
We've scored our first victory, and we couldn't have done it without your great organizing. Now, let's build on that win. The next fight? Getting President Trump to release his taxes. Why is this a big deal? Imagine, you're watching a football game, and you find out that the ref owns one of the teams. You think he'll make fair decisions? Until Trump releases his tax returns, we don't know whose side he's on. Russia? His golf courses? Mar-a-Lago? But it doesn't have to be this way. Congress can hold Trump accountable. This tax day, lace up your sneakers for tax day marches everywhere and tell your members of Congress to co-sponsor the Presidential Tax Transparency Act, or H.R. 305 in the House and S-26 in the Senate. These bills will require Trump and all future presidents to release their tax returns. You deserve to know whose interests Trump and his billionaire cabinet are really looking out for. This tax day, tell your member of Congress that we deserve to know. Go to indivisibleguide.com to find out.
You know, the only one that cares about my tax returns are the reporters, okay?
This weekend, across the country, people will be marching. The Tax Day March, also known as Trump's Tax Day, has been planned on April 15th to pressure Donald to release his tax returns. Marches have been organized in at least 119 cities in the United States, as well as international marches in the United Kingdom, in Germany, in New Zealand, and Japan. Why are we marching? What do we hope this will accomplish? Will it persuade Donald to release his taxes? No, probably not. But what it will do, it will show those in Congress who refuse to make him reveal his taxes, regardless of the fact that it is within their power to do so, and regardless of the fact that Democrats have tried repeatedly to pass such legislation, that we are serious about this. And we will make them pay come midterms should they fail to act. And they are on recess, so they will see people en masse in the streets of their home districts. These marches serve another purpose as well. They keep the resistance excited and engaged, looking towards midterms where there is always a drop-off in voter participation of young people, Democrats, and minorities. Who does that leave? White conservatives. Stacking the House and the Senate. Who needs that? So, use your voice. March like the kings and speak truth to power. Go to indivisible.com, or you could also go to taxmarch.org to find a march near you. Thank you for listening to K Voice of the Resistance, either on crabdiving.com or your favorite podcasting app. Like me and share me. Follow me on Twitter at Kelly the Voice and on Facebook at K Voice of Resistance. Catch the other great programming on crabdiving.com. That is one word, crabdiving.com. And get out and march this weekend. It'll feel good, I promise. Stay safe out there, and as always, resist.